Hey there, everybody. Arun Devatatil here again with episode, I believe we're up to episode 4 of Meshivat Nefesh. And it is a cold, very cold, very rainy, stormy Saturday night here in Jerusalem, in Kiryat Moshe, Jerusalem, Israel. We would say Shavua Tov in Hebrew. We say Shavua Tov, which means good week. Hope everybody has a that their week is successful and productive, and that they find a little more balance and find a little more, learn a little bit more about themselves, learn a little bit more about people that they care about, a little more about God, get a little bit closer to God, find out something more about how to relate to God. So in Judaism, our Sabbath is from Friday night to Saturday night. And that represents basically the last day of the week. So today, right now, is already the first day of the week. So in Judaism, the days start at nighttime and they go into the morning. So, yeah. So I'm, so for me, this is the new week. And thus we say Shavua Tov. Hope everybody has a good week. So, so I think where I left off last time was I had gotten introduced to traditional Judaism, what some people call Orthodox Judaism. I don't much like that term for, maybe I'll get into the reasons for that. But the way I understand, the way I relate to it is that this is the practice of halakha, of Jewish law, is the only historically consistent stream or way to practice a type of Judaism. So whilst somebody may be a Jew by birth, and according to halakha, they are a Jew by birth because their mother was Jewish, and their mother's mother was Jewish, and their mother's mother's mother was Jewish, or whatever, or their mother converted, and then they were born, and they converted under the auspices of halakha, of Jewish law, or whatever, something like that. There's a difference between who is a Jew and what is Judaism. Those are not the same. There's not always the same thing. And thus we can say, and that's why it's very easy to say, don't blame the Jews. Don't, you know, hold Judaism responsible for the actions of Jews. My understanding is that, my understanding of Jewish history, and based on my own reading and based on and my own study, is that the Jewish people, we emerged out of, and the reason I'm telling this story as part of my origin story is because I very much relate to, I very much personally related to a lot of these, these stories. I believe that especially each and every Jew, but really in a way, each and every person, no matter if they're Jewish or not, has some kind of journey like this, that this is the journey that all of us go through, when we, decide we're going to start taking our lives seriously and that we want to grow and become the best that we can be. I think all this stuff happens. I believe God, responds to our, hearts, inner desires for truth, and presents us with challenges in our lives to let us choose how we are going to be shaped by those things, and whether those challenges and those experiences are going to bring us closer to the truth, closer to our truth, what we are, what we're really about, or not, or the opposite. And that's based on Judaism, that's based on 12 steps, that's based on my own personal life, based on conversations I've had with other people. And so basically the Jewish people, we originated as a family in the ancient Near East, what's now called the Middle East. A man named Avram, who later became Abraham, and a letter was added to his name. But he grew up in a part of the world that where It was, you know, the cradle of civilization. Mesopotamia is the cradle of civilization. And there had at some point been a tradition of this one invisible, transcendent, totally incorporeal, divine creative intelligence, but also a personal, divine personal creative intelligence, meaning that that each of us have the ability to relate and connect to this intelligence in our own way, to this being, to this entity in our own way. There had been knowledge of that at some point, and it had been passed down, but it got lost over the years. And the Rambam, Maimonides, explains that one of the reasons is because it was too difficult for people. People started thinking, well, it's very hard for me to connect to this incorporeal creator who doesn't, you know, I've never heard him speak, I've never seen him, it's very hard for me to relate to that. But I do see the clouds, and I do see the sky, and I do see the sun, and I do see the stars, and I do see the planets, and I do see nature, forces of nature, in other words. And so people started, and well, so if the, but if so, if those are messengers, if those are agents of the one God, of Hashem, then maybe I can, you know, what's wrong with showing them a little bit of gratitude as well? And that eventually devolved over the generations into total nature worship and idolatry. So, and the tradition of the human ability to connect to transcendence was sort of lost. The ability to connect to a being who created us to be able to transcend ourselves, our finiteness, through connecting with him. That knowledge, that tradition had become lost. And it was rediscovered by a man named Abraham, who engaged in a lifetime of deep inner searching and questioning and listening to what his heart and his soul were telling him, which was that and actually the rabbinical tradition say that it was his kidneys. The kidneys in our tradition are the sort of the seat of of what you might call the conscience, or the inner voice, the inner knowledge of right and wrong, are actually seated in the kidneys. So he knew just very, very deeply, in a very deep, almost physical way, that there was this one God. If you don't like the word God, you can substitute whatever term works for you. But the concept, just to be clear, the concept I am describing is the creator, is the infinite oneness, who created the universe out of nothing, and who continues to breathe life and existence into all of reality at every moment, all the time, even right now. That is the power that I'm talking about. Just so you don't think I'm talking about, you know, some kind of other, you know, gosh, I don't know, some other kind of like pagan version, or some other idea. Or, you know, God forbid, some kind of like, whatever, some other kind of religion's idea of what God is. That is the God I'm talking about. So you don't have to say God. You can refer to it as Hashem, or the One, or the Holy One, or in the Jewish tradition alone, there are many, many names for him. But that is who we're talking about. I say who, not what, because he is personal. He stoops down, so to speak. He sort of makes himself small and relatable enough for us finite human beings to be able to have a relationship with him directly. And that's significant. I think that's very, very significant. And again, this is stuff that I first encountered in 12-step recovery, not through Judaism. And I found that it was that it I sensed it to be true, and practicing and living as though it were true made my life full. I felt more full, felt less depressed and less aimless. It was good. It was, you know, it was object. I could objectively say that it had made my life better. Coming to this way of living, this way of relating to myself and the world and this God, a sort of transcendent level of reality. And of course that means prayer. Prayer. It means meditation. It means, in the case of Jews, it means studying our holy texts, which we believe has been the divinely transmitted wisdom. There's a lot of wisdom which we can discover through intuition and through deep inner searching and soul searching. But there are some things that we would not know about, you know, the kind of the metaphysical reality. You know, what are the metaphysical rules that govern our world that we need to know about in order to relate to the world in a way that will create less harm and create more good. Just as there are physical laws that govern reality, so too there are metaphysical laws. And in Judaism, we call them the mitzvot, the commandments, which have a whole kind of body of oral law that accompanies it. And those have been analyzed and studied and discussed and debated over the generations, and finally codified in what we today call halakha, what we call Jewish law. So for a Jew, that is the practice, is studying Torah and practicing halacha. That is and prayer. Those are the main ways that we relate to this spiritual, transcendent reality of God or Hashem or the One or the Holy One or whatever you want to call him. Anyway, end sidebar. So back to what I was saying. So I went back to California for, you know, I had this kind of bomb dropped in my head about God and Judaism, and realized that Judaism is real and I can't just discount it as some old fashioned religion. And, you know, to say that all traditional religious people are backwards or whatever, because the people that I had met were definitely not backwards. They were not politically correct, and maybe some of their beliefs and ideas flew in the face of assumptions I had grown up with, but they weren't, I wouldn't say they weren't backwards. They knew what they were saying and why they were saying it. What really struck me, what really jumped out at me was, because I had never, you know, all this time growing up, knowing I was Jewish, the Jewish upbringing that I had, we had never even read the Bible, right? The Hebrew scriptures, which is our, you know, arguably the Jewish people's greatest contribution to humanity and civilization. I'd never read the Bible, never even read the first five books of Moses, which we call the Torah, the five books of the Chamisha Chumshe Torah, the five books of the Torah, which are Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, that we read in an annual cycle. I'd never read it all the way through, so I had no idea what actually it said, what Jews were, what our foundational document. I had only passing familiarity with, which is still better than a lot of other Jews that I know. And just the level of Jewish education in America is very sad. It makes me sad to think about just how painfully ignorant many Jews are of their own tradition. I seem to have noticed that Jews in the East Coast, especially in the New York area, even if they're not, you know, if they don't keep halacha, are at least more traditional or at least more learned or educated in terms of Jewish tradition. But certainly where I'm from in California, it's there are a lot of Jews and very few of them know anything, if anything, about Judaism. And certainly in my family, the level of Jewish education was very, very low. So I came to one of the things that really bowled me over was looking at the prophecies in the Tanakh, in the Hebrew Bible, especially in a few passages. There's a passage in particular in Deuteronomy. There's a few passages in Deuteronomy and other places, and other places in Tanakh and the prophets, like with Zechariah, like with Yechezkel, like with Yeshaya. Zechariah is like Zechariah, and Yechezkel is Ezekiel. Yeshaya is Isaiah. Other places in the prophets that describe things like us going, like Jewish people going into exile and not having a home, and the horrible fate that would befall us in exile, and the kinds of national struggles and insanity and division and confusion and sort of losing of our way that we would encounter, even while living in the land, like in the Book of Kings and Sefer Melachim, all the things that are going on there with foreign prophets and foreign influences and intermarriage with the king and a foreign queen, and how that leads to the Jews hunting down the very people, the prophets. Elijah, the prophet, has to go into hiding. The very people that have been sent to save us, become the kind of the enemies of the state. And certainly in the more I have been in Israel, the more I see how a Jewish society functions. It tries in many ways. Israel is an amazing country, and the army in particular, very moral army, blah blah blah, all that stuff is true. But in many ways, this country is very, very lost. The Jewish people are very lost. Don't know and don't really know right from wrong. Even the officially religious people, I would say, a lot of them are very lost. Don't really know. Yeah, they don't really know what they're doing. They're doing their best, but we don't stop to take a look at the big picture very much, unfortunately. But yeah, what really blew me away was how accurately the prophets described all these events and all these processes, both historically and how much of it is reflected in today's Jewish society in Israel, and the prophecies that were predicted that have already come true. That was amazing, that about the Jewish people coming back to Israel after a long period of exile, and the signs of how it would be manifested, like agriculture. That was a big one. That's the single biggest sign of that the final redemption is nearing, is agricultural renewal, that the land itself would become fertile again, because for many years the land in Israel was not fertile at all. It was, and for that reason, even though Israel was strategically very significant, it was almost impossible for any of the number of empires that tried to conquer it. It was virtually impossible for any of them to garrison any troops here, because there were very few natural resources to support an army. So whether it was Egypt or Rome or Greece or whoever, Media or whoever, any of these empires, they all had a very, very hard time maintaining a hold on this strip of land. So yeah, the fact that that we're back and that the land is back as well, that's amazing. That's a very clear sign that that something big is happening. Yeah, so those were things that really blew me away, and that's sort of what those are. That and other things as well. There are other things, I'm probably forgetting of them. There were a lot of things that convinced me that Judaism was not just true for me, but true in a more objective way. And I don't, not to say that the Jews are the, like, we have the monopoly on it. It is us as the, we are the chosen people. We're called a kingdom of priests, a holy nation. And what does a priest do? But a priest counsels and ministers to people who are seeking truth and seeking wisdom, seeking guidance, seeking advice. So, we exist to to help the other nations of the world in each of their individual missions. Each nation of the world has their own individual mission, but it is the job of the Jewish people to act as sort of the light to them and the coordinating the core, yeah, kind of the coordinator, the way Moses was with the Jewish people in the desert. You know, he was a leader, but you know, even when he wasn't leading, even when they didn't listen to him, he was still the coordinator. He was the representative and he was the coordinator. He had to coordinate how to get all the supplies for the tabernacle. He had to coordinate you know, giving judgments to people when there were monetary disputes or other kinds of disputes, damages and that kind of thing. He was a coordinator. He was a judge. He was an adjudicator, among other things. And that is supposed to be an example for us as Jews of how we're, I believe, of how we should relate to the nations. So it's not that, you know, it's not that there's some kind of it's not exclusive, because we also allow, we allow converts. We welcome converts. We try to, at least in theory, at least we welcome converts. So it's not like a racist thing. It's not a, it shouldn't be a thing about, it shouldn't be anything about arrogance. It shouldn't be anything about, you know, superiority or inferiority. It shouldn't be about that. It's got more to do with a responsibility, a duty, a sacred duty, which we are supposed to, which we're supposed to have taken up with joy and humility and gratitude. Anyway, so that all that kind of stuff really, really spoke to me. And again, I could go on at length about this, but maybe it'll come back. It'll come up at later points during my story. Went back to California, had sort of a little break, had a kind of a breakdown, realized that I couldn't go back to the way I'd been living before, which was really scary. Had to go forward, had to start learning more about Judaism, practicing it. Got a couple books, which I basically taught me a lot about, you know, helped me catch up in a very short period of time. So I sponged those up. Like one of the books I'll recommend is called Jewish Literacy by Joseph Telushkin, who is an Orthodox rabbi based out of, he grew up in Flatbush, Brooklyn. I'm not sure where he's based today, but he, you know, does speaking tours all around the U.S. and comes to Israel too. He's written a number of very, very large volumes, which are kind of meant to be single volume compendiums of, to, you know, to raise the level of Jewish literacy. And so this book called Jewish Literacy, it's basically how to just in one volume, it had history, both ancient medieval, you know, ancient medieval modern history of the Jews, things that are specific to the state of Israel, historical and spiritual phenomena and movements that have occurred throughout the Jewish people, important figures, of course, stories from the Bible and halachic, you know, legal and moral and ethical concepts, all these things. So it was about 1,000 pages of that, which I devoured over the course of about a month. Because, like I said, I needed to play. I was 26 already, so I needed to play catch up for all those years that I basically, you know, didn't learn anything about Judaism really. So I recommend that book. Kind of one of the big signs. I had started reading that book in Israel actually, but one of the big signs for me that it was and I purchased a copy when I got back to America. One of the big signs for me that it was, like, you know, a sign kind of from above that I was meant to continue on that path was basically, I think, like the week or 2 weeks after I got back from that Israel trip, Joseph Telushkin actually came to the Jewish Community Center near my house and was speaking in support of his new book. And so I went to go see him, and he had him autograph my book and met him. So that was nice. I continued practicing, and I got a lot of blowback from my parents and from my other relatives and from my friends, and people were confused and people didn't understand. Some people were supportive, But mostly people were not really sure. They were very confused. They didn't know what to make of it. Because like I said, where I'm from, people don't do that. People don't, it's seen as like going backwards. It's like you're going backwards if you become traditionally observant of, you know, if you become observant of some, you know, traditional, quote unquote, organized religion. By the way, as an aside, I don't believe, you know, people say like, yeah, you know, I don't really, it's like very nice, you know, Judaism, it's, you know, it's some nice ideas, but I can't really do organized religion. And my response to that is usually, well, that's good, because Judaism is anything but organized. We're kind of Dafka disorganized, almost like on purpose. The Talmud, the Babylonian Talmud, is very much out of order. And there's a general, there's a very, very loose order to it. But as you go through it, you find that it breaks off into tangents and tells stories and all kinds of random information that doesn't seem immediately relevant to the subject at hand. And on top of that, we have so many divisions in our just in the religious you know, in the religious community, so many divisions between, you know, those who are, you know, more modern and who are more Zionist or less Zionist, and then people who are the quote unquote ultra Orthodox, who are some who are adamantly anti-Zionist, some who are less anti-Zionist, some who are more open, and there are all these various gradations, and unfortunately, there's not always a meeting of the minds, and not always agreement, either socially or politically, between these groups, or religiously between these groups. So it's to call us an organized religion is kind of a misnomer. So, yeah, because we're not just a religion, we're a people as well. That's that plays a very important part. You can't understand Jewish religion without understanding the people, the nation aspect of it. So I started finding out more about Judaism and trying to put into practice things I had learned, things like Shabbat. And Shabbat is very hard to keep, even now that I know a lot more about of all the laws. There are a lot of laws, very hard to keep in its entirety. I try my best. I'm fairly knowledgeable. I'd like to think I'm fairly knowledgeable about the laws of Shabbat, of the Sabbath. But there are a lot. But I, you know, like I said, I do my best. And you know, other things like keeping kosher, that was really hard. Very, very hard to keep kosher where I lived. I was living with my parents for a few months. Almost impossible to keep kosher there. So I didn't, you know, I wasn't like, but like I said, you know, I learned in recovery that, you know, easy does it is a big piece of any journey, that I shouldn't try to jump to some kind of absolute idealized version of what I want to be, what I would like to be in the future. I need to be where I am now and relate to the reality that I was in, which is that my parents do not have a kosher kitchen at all. I don't think my mom's eaten kosher food a handful of times in her life. Probably half of that time was when she was with me, when she came to visit me in Israel, or when we went out to eat in Golders Green in London or something like that. But yeah, kosher food is not was a novelty. So I slowly started to put things into practice. I found where a few communities were, got kind of scooped up by a young rabbi who was working in Jewish outreach in San Francisco. So he was great. His family was amazing, and they were very, very good to me. Like I said, there was a Chabad house very close to where my parents lived. That rabbi was also very, very good to me, and later very, very helpful to my parents and my father especially. I don't have many negative things to say about the about Chabad Shluchim. I think they're very noble and sweet and good and altruistic people. They're doing they mean absolutely well. Some of the most altruistic people on the planet. I might not agree now with, you know, 100% of their kind of theology, but I have immense respect for those people who do that work. I have immense respect. So So I started to, putting these things into practice slowly, slowly, and realized that I needed to go back. I was going to have to spend some time learning in yeshiva. There was just no, I was scared to kind of come out with that to my family, but eventually I did it. Again, there was blowback. All this whole, even to this day, there I've gotten blowback. People don't understand, or people think it's weird, or people think, I don't know, people think that I think that I'm judging them, or all kinds of just crazy stuff that people projected onto me. I found out very quickly that a lot of my family and relatives and friends are not as open-minded or accepting as they would like me to think, or like people to think. It really, me becoming religious really brought up a lot of stuff for people, people in my life that I cared about and that care about me. I won't go into all the nitty-gritty details, but I'll tell, I can tell, think if there's any stories I can, if I can tell that will be appropriate, that won't offend too many listeners. Okay, so there's one story. I started, just after I'd been back a few months, I started practicing something called Shmirat Negiah, which literally means guarding touch, keeping touch, which it's actually the opposite. It should have a better name would be like Shmirat Harchaka or something like that, keeping distance, or Shmirat Merchak, Mashu Kaze, something like that. Because the idea is that in halacha, that any friendly or affectionate physical contact between men and women should be restricted to only the closest relationships. Parents, grandparents, like so, mothers, grandmothers, or, yeah, parents, sorry, parents, grandparents, children, grandchildren, and spouse. So that means cousins are out. Aunts and uncles are out. Close friends are out. Ex-wife is out. Ex-girlfriend, all that stuff. There shouldn't be any physical contact, any affectionate physical contact. I decided to take that on fairly early because, as I mentioned, I really struggled in the area of my relationships with women, young women. And when I say young, I mean anywhere from the age of consent to the mid th to their mid-30s. I really did was not very I was not very discriminating in that area of my life at all. And so I wanted to create a very something very strong and very firm and very clear that could help me, that would protect me from myself, basically, from my own desires. And I decided to take on that particular practice of keeping physical distance, not touching women. So basically the only woman I touched was my mother. So my grandmother had passed away not long after I started becoming religious. My grandmother passed away not long after that, after this time period that I'm describing. So my mother, and I don't have any daughters, so or granddaughters, so that's, obviously not. So is my mother, my grandmother, and I wasn't married, so that was it. So for a long time, and then I came to Israel where, I didn't see my mother, so I didn't have any contact with women, at least not intentionally, for several years until I got married, except for when my mom would come to visit. That was it. That was my choice. Really, I'm very grateful. I don't have any regrets about doing it. I have regrets, as you'll hear from the story, about kind of the way I, sort of the way I implemented it, or the way it affected other people in my life, and that I could have done more to kind of mitigate those effects. If I'd been a little bit more sensitive, a little more sensitive to the feelings of others. I was at a 12-step meeting in San Francisco, that I was a regular at. There were a lot of young people, a lot of people under 40, And a lot of friends that I had that went there, and you know, it was good for me to, you know, I enjoyed going to this meeting. And so I get to the meeting one day a few minutes early. I'm there like 50 minutes early, and I see a couple, you know, a couple guys that I'm friends with, and I go over there, and you know, I hug them and I see them, and I'm catching them up on my trip to Israel, and you know, how it's, you know, I'm like getting into Judaism, and like you know, whatever, having a conversation. And a friend of mine, a female friend of mine, who is a dear, dear friend, who I'd known for, you know, known for several years, she's like, you know, kind of like a kind of a big sister. She sees me, and you know, hadn't seen me in months because I'd been in Israel for 3 months, and she comes up and she wants a hug. And I was very uncomfortable because she was expecting a hug. You know, I have my two other buddies standing here who are all friends. And I said to her, "Oh gosh, I'm sorry, I don't hug women anymore." And she got very hurt, very offended. She was embarrassed, of course, because we had our other friends standing there. And she got very upset with me and went to go sit down. And then after the meeting, I think I got asked to speak at that meeting. I think I was even the speaker at that meeting. I was sharing my story of addiction recovery at that meeting. And after the meeting, we all go out to eat. You know, as was the custom, many of us go out to a restaurant to eat. I don't know if I ate anything. Maybe I just got a salad or something like that. Because like I said, I was trying to I was trying to practice kosher eating habits, but it was very difficult. When you know, all of your friends are going out to eat at a restaurant, you know, what do you? And it's not a kosher restaurant. You know, what are you supposed to do? So whatever, I think I could, you know, get a salad or whatever. It's pretty safe. It's pretty safe bet that it was technically kosher, but who knows? And I had called. I think I called my sponsor. I don't remember if I called my sponsor. Maybe I just knew from something my sponsor told me before. My sponsor was a big believer in, if you cause harm, yeah, if you cause harm in an interaction with a friend or somebody, or a coworker, whoever, anybody, whether it's intentional or unintentional, there was a miscommunication, whatever it was, as soon as you catch yourself, as soon as you realize that you did something wrong and you feel some remorse for it, you should not delay at all. Promptly, this is step 10. Step 10 of the 12 steps says we continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. So prompt admission, not letting it fester, not letting it wait, not, you know, not sleeping on it. And so whether I don't remember if I'd spoken to my sponsor or not, but I knew from, you know, I it was it, I don't know if it mattered that much because this is something my sponsor was big on. So I knew to just go over and I went into the restaurant. And I said, "Look, can we go sit? Is there somewhere where we can go sit and speak for a few minutes?" And she didn't want to. And one of her friends was like, you know, one of our friends, Ned, you know, Alberta, and said, like, "Come on, you know, go." And so she came out inside and sat with me, and she basically aired out all of her. I guess she grew up kind of Catholic. I believe her last name is Irish. I won't, and I'm not using her name, obviously. She grew up, you know, Irish family in Baltimore. I don't know, whatever religious or Catholic upbringing she had was probably not very positive, because what she had to say was very harsh, very negative, and you know that it's all bull crap and it's all made up and blah blah blah, and I just listened. That's all I wanted. It's all I was trying to do. That was my only mission, was so that she would feel heard and that I listened. And I didn't respond. I just said, "Yeah, look, I'm sorry you feel that way. I did not mean to offend you or embarrass you. This is something that's important to me. I definitely think I could have handled it better." And she was obviously still hurt, but I think she accepted that. We haven't really spoken so much since then, and that was about 8 years ago. So you know that there was it has not been. I have made sacrifices for this life. Even before I came to Israel, I was already, you know, I was already making big sacrifices. But it all added to, I see, looking back today, I see how it all added to it. There's a, my life is a, my inner life, my spiritual life is very rich. I have, I have insight into relationships now that most guys my age do not. And so I'm very, I'm grateful for things like that. I'm grateful for experiences like that. And I'm grateful for the ability to share them with whoever might be listening. So that's all for tonight. I look forward to doing another recording tomorrow night and continuing my journey up until today. Okay, be well. Shavuot Tov. Good week.